right, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're going to be looking at judicial corruption, specifically a landmark case, United States v. Maloney. Now, this isn't just another case in the books. This 1993 Seventh Circuit decision really kind of reshaped how we think about RICO, Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times when we think about RICO, we think about, you know, the mob, organized crime, that kind of thing. But Maloney, it comes out of Operation Greelord, which was this massive investigation into judicial corruption in Cook County, Illinois. And it really shows how RICO can be used to combat corruption, even within the justice system itself. And this case raises some really interesting questions about when exactly a conspiracy ends, especially when you have, like, bribe money being returned.
So you're saying that this case sort of, like, broadens our view of how RICO can be applied. It's not just for the mafia anymore. It's for, like, white-collar crime, too?
Exactly. And Maloney really digs deep into some really complex areas of conspiracy law, which is, you know, especially relevant for you law students out there trying to wrap your heads around all this stuff. So what we're going to do today is break down how RICO was used in this case and look at some of the, well, frankly, the evidentiary challenges that came up when trying to prove this huge conspiracy.
So let's dive right in. I mean, Judge Maloney was, like, running a criminal enterprise right from the bench. Can you kind of, like, walk us through how that actually worked?
Sure. So the prosecution had to show a pattern of racketeering activity and that this activity was connected to Maloney's role as a judge. And they did this by piecing together a ton of evidence. Like, there was testimony about how Maloney was getting bribes through these intermediaries. We call them bagmen. Two key players were Robert Cooley and William Swano. They were basically the middlemen moving the money around.
Okay, so you've got the judge, got the bagmen. Yeah. And what were they, like, bribing him for?
They were bribing him to fix cases. And we're not talking about, like, parking tickets here. We're talking about murder cases, really serious stuff. Some of these cases even involve the El Rucan gang, which was a really powerful, pretty dangerous street gang in Chicago at the time. Mm-hmm. And the prosecution also used financial records to show that Maloney had a lot of wealth that couldn't be explained by his salary as a judge.
So, you know, just to clarify, it wasn't just that, like, people were saying he was taking bribes, but there was also this trail of, like, suspicious financial activity that backed up those claims.
Exactly. And all this evidence together, the direct testimony and the circumstantial evidence, it painted a really clear picture of Maloney as the head of this corrupt operation. But there were a couple of pieces of evidence that were, like, the real knockout punches for the prosecution.
Yeah. What were those? What were the smoking guns in this case?
Well, two big things. First, there were these recordings from 1990 called the Standing Tall recordings. These were conversations between Maloney and Swano. And even though the exact contents weren't immediately made public, it was pretty clear that they were talking about, continuing their illegal activities and trying to cover their tracks. And then there was this whole issue with benefits being given to some of the key witnesses. This wasn't revealed until after the trial, but it turned out that the prosecution had, you know, cut some deals with these witnesses, especially some folks connected to the El Rucan gang. This really raised questions about how reliable their testimony actually was.
So, okay, that brings us to the appeal, right? And this is where it gets especially interesting for law students. There were two major legal arguments that Maloney's defense team made. One was about the statute of limitations for RICO conspiracy, and the other was about, you know, prosecutorial misconduct. So let's start with the statute of limitations. How long does someone have before they can't be prosecuted for RICO offense?
5 years. That's the limit.
Okay, 5 years. So Maloney's defense argued that too much time had passed. What were they basing that on?
Well, the defense argued that the last overt act in this whole conspiracy, that is the last action that was directly in furtherance of the conspiracy, happened more than 5 years before Maloney was charged. They were pointing to those Standing Tall conversations from 1990 as the last overt act. And Maloney actually left the bench in 1990 as well. So their argument was essentially that once he was off the bench, the conspiracy to fix cases was over and the clock started ticking.
So the defense was saying that, like, the last crime happened in 1990, he left his job in 1990, and therefore it was all, like, in the past.
Yeah, that was their argument. But the prosecution had a different view, and they were able to convince the court that the conspiracy actually continued even after Maloney stepped down.
How did they do that? What was their reasoning?
Well, they focused on this idea of continuity in RICO law. Remember, to prove a RICO violation, you have to show a pattern of racketeering activity connected to an enterprise. The enterprise in this case was essentially Maloney's position as a judge, the way he was misusing his office for his own personal gain. And the prosecution argued that this enterprise, this corrupt structure, continued to exist as long as he held that position, even if he wasn't actively fixing cases anymore. Plus, they argue that those standing tall conversations, they weren't just, you know, reminiscing about past crimes. They were part of an ongoing effort to cover up the conspiracy and protect Maloney's ability to potentially fix more cases in the future. And then, of course, there was all that financial evidence, which the prosecution said was, you know, further proof that the racketeering activity was ongoing.
I see. So it wasn't just about individual acts of bribery. It was about this whole system of corruption that Maloney had created. And that system remained in place even after he left the bench.
Exactly. It's about the structure, not just the individual acts.
Okay. So now let's talk about the withdrawal defense. Maloney's attorneys argued that even if the conspiracy was still going on, he had actually withdrawn from it because he returned some of the bribe money. How does that work legally? Like, can you just, like, give the money back and be done with it?
Well, not quite. It's not that simple. You can't just, like, undo a conspiracy by returning some of the profits. The law requires something more active. To successfully claim withdrawal, you have to show that you took affirmative steps to defeat the purpose of the conspiracy. You have to really try to dismantle it. And in Maloney's case, the court wasn't convinced that returning the money was enough.
Because he was still a judge, right?
Yeah, that was a big part of it. He was still in a position of power where he could potentially, you know, continue the corrupt activities. So the court basically said that returning the money, while it might show he was having second thoughts, didn't actively disrupt the ongoing potential for corruption that was inherent in his position. It's a tricky distinction, but it's an important one.
Yeah, sounds like it. Okay, and then the final big issue in this case was the allegation of prosecutorial misconduct. You know, those undisclosed benefits that were given to the Elrucken witnesses. That sounds pretty serious. Can you explain, like, why that's such a big deal legally and why it didn't ultimately lead to Maloney's conviction being overturned?
Sure. So this all comes down to what's called a Brady violation. It's based on a Supreme Court case, Brady v. Maryland. And it basically says that prosecutors have to disclose any evidence that could be favorable to the defense. This includes evidence that could be used to impeach a witness, meaning to cast doubt on their credibility. And in Maloney's case, those undisclosed benefits, well, they could have been used to argue that the Elrucken witnesses weren't reliable. You know, maybe they were just saying what the prosecution wanted to hear in exchange for those benefits. But the court ultimately decided that this didn't warrant overturning the conviction. And their reasoning was based on the concept of materiality.
Materiality. So, like, how important the evidence is.
Right. So, under Brady, the evidence has to be material to the outcome of the trial, meaning there has to be a reasonable probability that if the defense had known about this evidence, the jury would have reached a different verdict. And in Maloney's case, the court said that even though the Elrucken witnesses were important, their testimony wasn't the only evidence against him. Remember, there was also testimony from the lawyers who paid the bribes, those standing tall recordings, and all that financial evidence.
So the court was saying that, like, even if the jury hadn't believed the Elrucken witnesses, there was still enough other evidence to convict Maloney.
Exactly. They concluded that those undisclosed benefits, while troubling, wouldn't have actually changed the outcome of the trial.
It's interesting, though, because it wasn't a unanimous decision, right? There was a dissenting opinion in this case.
Right. It was a 2-1 decision. Which means that one of the judges on the panel disagreed with the majority opinion. And this dissent actually raises some really important points.
Yeah, what were some of the key arguments that the dissenting judge made?
Well, the dissenting judge, Judge Ripple, had some real concerns about both the statute of limitations issue and the prosecutorial misconduct. On the statute of limitations, he argued that returning the bribe money could be seen as, like, a genuine attempt to withdraw from the conspiracy. And he wasn't convinced that those standing call conversations were actually part of the original bribery scheme. He thought they might have been more like separate acts of obstruction that happened after the fact. But his biggest concern was with the undisclosed witness benefits. He argued that this prosecutorial misconduct created what he called a trial fog, meaning it made it really difficult for the jury to properly evaluate the evidence, even if the Elrucken testimony wasn't the only evidence against Maloney. He was worried that Maloney didn't get a fair trial because of this.
So this split decision really shows how complex these issues are and how, you know, reasonable legal minds can disagree on these things. It's a good reminder that the law isn't always black and white. There's a lot of gray area.
Absolutely. And this case really brings some core principles of RICO law into focus. I mean, it shows how important it is to understand things like continuity, the difference between terminating a conspiracy and withdrawing from one, and how Brady violations are evaluated. It's all pretty nuanced stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So stepping back a bit, what do you think is the lasting impact of this case? Like, how did Maloney change the way we think about corruption and RICO?
Well, Maloney really expanded our understanding of RICO. Before this case, a lot of people thought RICO was mainly for, you know, traditional organized crime. But Maloney showed that it can be a really powerful tool for prosecuting white-collar crime and public corruption, especially within the judicial system. And it also highlighted how important it is for prosecutors to be transparent and disclose any deals they make with witnesses, even after a trial is over. We're still grappling with these issues today, you know, with concerns about conflicts of interest and influence within the legal system.
Absolutely. And this case really leaves us with some tough questions, like, should returning illegal profits, you know, like bribe money, be enough to absolve someone of their past involvement in a criminal conspiracy? And how much prosecutorial misconduct is acceptable, even in cases where the defendant seems clearly guilty? I mean, those are really difficult questions.
They are. And they really go to the heart of our justice system. You know, we want to hold people accountable for wrongdoing, but we also want to make sure that everyone gets a fair trial. It's a constant balancing act.
So to wrap things up for our listeners out there, what are the three key takeaways from United States v. Maloney?
Three big things to remember. First, WIO conspiracies, they don't just magically end. They continue until the purpose of the enterprise is truly finished. Second, withdrawing from a conspiracy requires more than just stopping. It requires taking active steps to defeat the conspiracy. And third, when it comes to Brady violations, the key question is whether the undisclosed evidence could have reasonably changed the outcome of the trial. Not just whether it was, you know, technically exculpatory.
Excellent. Great points to keep in mind. And speaking of landmark cases, next time on The Deep Dive, we're going to be tackling McDonnell v. U.S. It's a really fascinating case that deals with the definition of official acts in public corruption cases. That's going to be a good one.
Oh, yeah. McDonnell's a big one. Lots to unpack there.
Definitely. But until then, remember, even judges are not above the law. And RICO, well, RICO has a long reach.